Okay, this is Bob and Cameron meeting for the 21st time on April 8th, 2021. And we're going into the content of my book in quotes. It was meant to be an article, but then it went on for quite a long stretch. So jokingly, I call it a pamphlet, or as McLuhan would say, a broadside. But it's pretty long. 190 pages or so, internet pages, or what is this, Word document pages? What are these pages?
Well, they're would-be print pages.
Would-be print. So 8 yeah. by 11?
It wouldn't necessarily be 8 by 11. It would all depend on the paper size, but it's set up to print in regulation size paper.
And that's 8 by 11, right?
Well, it is here, but it's not in Europe, so.
Oh, what's it in Europe?
It's a little bit longer, and it might be a tad less wide as well, but I'm not exactly sure of the dimensions. For one thing, it's 8.5 by 11 is inches, and of course they don't have inches.
Oh, yeah. See, you ask a silly, simple question, doesn't hurt, learn something.
There you go. Let me say something about pamphlet. When people hear the word pamphlet in North America, they tend to think of something short, something like a brochure or something, and certainly not like a book.
Yeah.
But Wyndham Lewis and McLuhan use pamphlet in the English sense. And the English sense of pamphlet is something that pamphleteers, something that takes up a position and is combative towards another position or other positions. So a 400-page book for Lewis and McLuhan can be a pamphlet. Mm. It's just that they're speaking English, not North American English.
Yeah, and so there's a technical definition of pamphlet as a with a certain motive?
Well, I mean, Bob, you know from Finnegan's Wake that there's no such thing as a technical definition in language. It all depends on where you are and who you are and who you're speaking to and who's listening and all that sort of stuff. So it's just in England, the English use pamphlet in regard to writing of any length, and in North America we don't.
So any length, but is it it's not fiction?
Well, I don't know. Some of it I can imagine fiction book being largely pamphleteering, but I don't really know. I don't speak English that well to know. All I know is that in reading Lewis and McLuhan, it's fairly clear that they use pamphlet to refer to pamphleteering and not to the length of a book or a brochure.
Right. What's the broadside? Got anything to say about that?
Well, broadside was a newspaper, right? So a broadside, I believe, began as a newspaper with a decided point of view, something that attempted to lodge the sort of broadside that a English naval ship might lodge against a French ship or a Spanish ship.
Weaponized.
And I think, pardon me?
It's weaponized writing.
Yes.
To use a new term.
So then it went from having a newspaper reference to really being a kind of verb. Right?
A verb?
A broadside begins as a type of action. A naval action goes to being a type of newspaper, and then with us, if it's used at all, it's nearly always used as a verb.
Right. Do you remember about 1978, McLuhan made that pamphlet, the brochure, he had it made up about the new nature and the replace. Maybe it was called There Is No Nature or something. It was about the effect of Sputnik. And at the bottom, he called it a broadside.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's sort of like a counterblast.
Yeah, counterblast.
Yeah.
You haven't
no,
seen
I've
that.
Never seen it.
Never
I've
saw
never
that.
Seen it, but I know that in 1974, Louis Forsdale said to McLuhan something like, do I understand you correctly that Mother Nature is dead? And McLuhan answers, yes, the hand that rocked the cradle has kicked the bucket.
Right. And he has that statement, that aphorism in Counterblast 69, talking about the Beatles music. It says that, the Beatles music proves that the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world.
And there you go.
Yeah, and then 5 years later, kicked the bucket. It's not there anymore. The Beatles broke up. Okay, so we're looking at Appendix 2, which is an interview with the tech body. Do you have a question, or do you want me to say some things for a minute?
Up to you.
All right. This pamphlet is to say, answer the question, what you didn't know about Trump. I knew about it, but I didn't want to be arrogant. So I put in the royal we, right? What we/you didn't know about Trump. So what did people not know about Trump? The most discussed phenomenon in a long time. Well, what they didn't know is that Trump was produced by the tech body. What the heck is the tech body? So, I learned about the tech body from Ion, who's well-versed in McLuhan and Lewis and my charts and my stuff in the five bodies. He's very up on it. I don't know when Ion became up on it. When they first came through in March 2009, for the first 6 months, I bring up McLuhan, they'd put it down. They'd put McLuhan down rapidly.
Why do you say they?
Oh, they're plural. They're actually an environment. They're not entities. They're not channel entities. They are the actual Jewish term, the Guf, G-U-F. That's how they define themselves. Well, what's the Guf? You look it up on Wikipedia, it's the place in Jewish religion where souls go, or in other words, heaven. So there's apparently a theological view of the Bible that says, that the Bible says that heaven will merge with earth at some point, at the second coming, approximately, of Jesus Christ. Have you ever heard of that idea?
No.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, let's differentiate. Have I ever heard of apocalypse and end of the world and all that? Of course I have. I ever heard about Guff or something? No.
Right, but you and you haven't heard the point that heaven merges with earth?
No.
After the Armageddon and apocalypse. Well, that's apparently, according to Ion, what Scripture's all about, and I think other religions predict this. So Ion is the manifestation of that. It is non-physical, or heaven, or the Guff, that is merged with physical. So for 6 months, me talking to Ion, which to my delight, would talk for endless hours for free. I didn't have to pay for it. The Evergreens were $500 for an hour. And I did 24 years of sessions with them, 64 sessions, I think. A lot of money spent from 1980 to 2004. but with Ion, I could talk every night as long as I wanted. And JW's experience of this, JW, the person that Ion spoke through, he loved it because it, while he was in this altered state, he'd be feeling a constant orgasm. I don't know if he felt it during the experience or when he came out of the altered state, his memory of what he'd just been experiencing was a constant orgasm. But yeah, because it's there's no time in JW's experience of this situation, very little. So It's a mystery what Ion is. That's very dramatic to say that the final merging of heaven and earth is evoked by Bob accidentally on March 18th, 2009.
Why don't you, I mean, it's typical of the Gutenberg galaxy to imagine that truth and reality and finality are singular.
Well, that's not what Ion says. Ion totally agrees with you. And my dating things and making linear, Ion will have none of it. That's why Ion says two important books to read are the Bible and Finnegan's Wake, the two books that bracket, you know, the Gutenberg galaxy. So Ion is very up with you, Cameron. You don't know it. You haven't heard Ion talk, but I know Ion. I know what they say. And matter of fact, when you ask questions, you're not allowed to. Basically, Ion objects to what he calls 6 degrees of separation. Who, what, when, where, why, how. No such things exist. So that's anti-visual space there.
But that's what I mean by Gutenberg perspective, is if, I mean, you were talking about the merger of the physical and heaven, right? So merger is the idea that the what was different is going to become the same.
Yes. Right? Well, Ion doesn't say they become the same, but they start interacting very closely.
Uh-huh.
The veil is gone. That's the technical term. The veil has been thinning, and now it's gone. The veil shows up in religious literature, that term. Maybe you've heard it.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, so the veil is gone. Now, that's a finality. That's Gutenbergian finality. It's sort of been thinning and going, and we may not have completed the process if you talk to Ion about it. So, for 6 or so months, I was just learning. What the hell am I talking to? I had no clue, and I didn't know how significant it was going to be. And Ion would not have me discuss McLuhan or anybody, Bucky Fuller. If they had died, they weren't worth talking about. So I found out from Ion's point of view that all those that never died are significant humans, like Saint Germain and Abraham, you know, the guy that almost sacrificed his son. His wife Sarah is still around, listens to the show regularly, and all kinds of other crazy stuff. Those people Ion talks about. So
you said Saint Germain or something?
Yeah, Saint Germain is a famous mystic. There's cults around Saint Germain. He lived 200 or 300 years ago. He never died. Been around a long time. Still involved today. Was actually very involved with 911, but that's a whole lot. We're not going to get into Ion stuff, okay? I'm just giving you the introduction of the tech body. So after 6 months or so, Ion had been considering my tiny node chart and my five-body model. And he said, you know, Bob, we're going to allow you to discuss, in your terms, the five-body model and what was the other thing? Oh, the tetrad, say, but no, five-body model. And do you remember me saying? I don't know. My tiny note chart. Yeah, tiny note chart. So, but he said, if you mention McLuhan, that's okay. But after you say what McLuhan says, and you quote McLuhan, you then must say, however, Bob says, and that was the rule. I always had to qualify whatever McLuhan said, and that was okay with me because I thought I had gone, quote, past McLuhan with the five-body model that he didn't get to. I had the advantage of the chip body era. He didn't, though he made some general points. So McLuhan was useful up to a point. But then when Ion, talking about my five bodies, and then mentioned the hexatic body, which was the sixth position, which my tiny node chart predicts. Remember the hex advertisement, the advertisement for the hexatic sixth level? There's a body associated with it, and involved with all the transformation that's happened in the world since March 18, 2009, that ION claims to be a catalyst for through Carol and I, including the Arab Spring. So IMAC's preposterous claims that pretty well everything that's happened since the crash of the fall of 2008, the economic American Wall Street crash, has been organized by ION. But about 2 years ago, a year and a half, Trump had been president for a few years. ION started talking about the tech body. So what's that? And ION was not that forthcoming in describing it. Little drops were provided. You can go to one of my websites, ionandbob.com, and look up the tech body section, and I have all the different excerpts from my private sessions with ION or stuff he said in public on the radio, inventorying different stages of what the tech body is, or different the definitions. So the tech body, so ION starts talking about it in 2019 after a 2-year hiatus. They came back in April 2019. They talked to us in that hiatus, but they weren't doing public stuff because Trump had become president. ION knew there'd be nothing but people asking about Trump, you know, the mania of, say, 2017, early 2017 up till 2019, people obsessed with Trump. And ION considered that a huge distraction and wasn't going to engage people who would only ask about that, so withdrew from the public scene on purpose. Now, here's an interesting point. Q shows up. You've heard of the Q phenomenon, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, when ION came back in April 2019, one of the first questions everybody was interested, the regulars, was, what the hell is this Q thing? Well, the Q thing was from the astroplane, and it was set up by ION to fill in while ION was not available for 2 years. So I don't think any of the Q people know this. They haven't contacted us. They haven't heard us speak about it. But anyways, Q is a subplot of ION. And once ION came back in 2019, Q started to get talked about by the New York Times and the major media, which kills a topic. If you get on that level, you're gone. The people who want you to be different don't like mainstream banalization of it. So Q started to falter, and I don't even know what its status is now. It's not that prominent. But we're prominent, and we're better than Q. So, or at least ION is.
So but you have regular postings from Q on your website.
No, we don't. We don't promote Q. We never did.
No, but you have. I don't know, call it a promotion, but certainly you have broadcasts about. I never listened to them, so I don't know if they're by or about. But,
by Q?
Yeah, almost every day.
I've never seen those. What website are you talking about?
Yeah, ION and Bob.
Wow. No, there's no Q. Maybe occasionally Ed, who runs it, he lives on another Hawaiian island, Kauai, the most primitive island. He may excerpt Q, but I haven't seen that in months. No, we don't promote Q. There may be someone.
Yeah, well.
What happens is there's Ed Long scans the fringe media, the banned media. And all these different speakers and features them. They talk about Q.
Maybe. Because I don't listen, I don't know what they're about.
Are you saying you see the word Q?
Yeah, sure.
Wow, no, I've never seen that. I'll look again, but I look at it every day. I don't know. Anyway.
Well, I'll send you a link.
Okay, but no, I want to see how it looks. Take a picture.
Yeah, so here's, for example, on the 5th of April, so a couple days ago,
yeah,
you've got the X-22 report.
Right.
Right? So isn't X-22 associated with Q?
I don't know anything about it. What it is usually, there's a lot of these characters that Ed puts on. X-22 is one of them. I just listened to one the other day for the first time. They are interested in Q. They talk about
yes.
Q. But there's no title Q in the entry you're talking about. Where is it?
Not in that particular one, but there are in others. But anyway,
not many.
It's yeah. not important. It's not important.
Well, no, it's important if people think we're promoting Q. And Ed is playing these people who talk about Q, pro and con. But we don't. I mean, he's just posting these people and what they say. If they talk about Q, that's okay. They talk about it, but it's not the only thing they talk about. But a lot of them are oriented around their big picture is Q derivative, you know. They really try to ransack Q's posts over the last couple of years to see pointers to what's happening to today. And they'll claim there's prophetic stuff. But
Q is a kind of rival to you, Bob.
Me or Ion? Or
well, I don't know. To the whole
To Ion
group there.
but that's the point, is that it fits. When Q started happening, a couple of people who were familiar with Ion, you know, very familiar, they thought Q was Ion. They could see a similarity or something. And I assured them, no, we were not Q. But Ion didn't tell me what he told 2 years later, that they were a subplot. Matter of fact, we never talked about Q at all much. But when Ion came back in April 2019, people wanted to know about Q, and so then Ion gave their statement about it. But Ed features these people with their different views, and they do all kinds of stuff, but a lot of them have Q. But Ed's not promoting anybody. He just shows the range of alternative views to counter the mainstream stuff. And he's very good at it. I mean, I've enjoyed a lot of the people he's found. Just as an interesting what's going on. I've always been interested in the fringe and track it, and Ed provides that for me. I never asked him. He did it on his own. Okay, so maybe
you're going through the...
Yeah, the tech body. So I'm explaining the hexatic body was the world. See, every one of my bodies is originally a landscape. Television was a landscape when it was the hidden ground of the 50s and 60s, say. Once everything is digitized, then those landscapes, TV and radio, become little nodes on your Palm Pilot 20 years ago or on your smartphone. They become miniaturized and shrunk. And that is changing a TV landscape to a content of the digital, a TV body. So we've been
right,
adding.
So you don't mean that the old landscapes have shrunk in a physical sense. You mean that the new media refigure the old media. And they don't disappear, but they become transfigured.
Right, and for young people, they didn't experience television like we did or radio. It's just a screen inside their smartphone. Like they don't. It's not even TV.
Yeah. I think it's the exactly like McLuhan experienced radio in a way that. People of a later generation like myself never did.
Yeah.
Right? And that's because radio at a certain point in time, I don't know, 1910 to 50, let's say.
Transistors in the 50s. Transistor radios in the late 50s, early 60s.
Yeah, but radio was, for example, I can remember listening to the World Series in recess in Regina when I was like in grade four or something. And for us, that radio coming out of New York, because the Yankees were the only team in the World Series for those years in the early 50s. For us, the radio was sort of our window to the world in that sense. And but that was something that happened in recess, and we also, you know, had a television at home and all this sort of stuff. So McLuhan knew the period when the radio was the only window. And so then he brings that experience of radio into his later experiences with other media.
Yeah.
And I think what we're talking about here with the different landscapes or the different bodies is that process of reconfiguration, of transformation that occurs whenever you have new media.
Right. And the landscape phase is when it's a general environment, everybody's sharing, it's all the same. Once you have digital customization and different kinds of way people have phones, that's taking the landscape and shrinking it so it's an organ attached to your chemical body, or it's a body itself. I like to say it's a new body overlaid the chemical body or the physical body. And so that's a later phase.
Yeah.
Right. So the hexatic was an environment with ion. I claim that ion, as I got to understand ion through the years, is a new technology and a new environment, a hidden environment. And as so it was called the hexatic by me and ion. But then in 2019, he starts talking about the tech body. Following the principle that a landscape has become miniaturized or reconfigured, tech body is technically, within ion's language, the post-landscape phase of the hexatic, right? The hexatic landscape becomes the tech body.
So is this the seventh body?
It's a mutation of the sixth body, a reconfiguring of the sixth body, because the five bodies were the physical body, which I call the chemical body, because chemical Western science dominated the imaging of that for 150 years. And then you have the astral body, traditional non-physical phenomena in different cultures. Then you have the TV body, and then you have the chip body, and then you have the mystery body. But at the time I made the body terms, the mystery, I didn't know anything about the mystery landscape. So it was still a landscape. Then Ion shows up and explains the mystery landscape, so we start to know the mystery body. So those were the five bodies. And for years, I only described four of them because I didn't know anything about the mystery landscape. I just supposed there was stuff we didn't know we're going to find out about. And I was right. Ion showed up to be part of the mystery landscape and to explain it, therefore making it knowable. And so that's the tech body. So in 2019, we started to hear Ion talk about the tech body. And it was something out there. Some people thought, oh, it's the Android Bob's Android meme. But no, Ion said this is beyond the Android meme. And I explain in the pamphlet what I mean by Android meme, phase one and phase two, before you get to the tech body. But we're at the end of the pamphlet, and we're dealing with the tech
but
body.
We'll go into that, but backwards.
Yeah. But we're given the punchline. And we're going to explain the joke. That may take a while. And I don't mean by joke it's not serious. I think it's very serious. But just making a joke about being serious. So in 2019, we got Trump running around for a couple of years. And Ian's starting to explain the little bits here and there what the tech body is. Then one day, they said that the tech body put Trump in the White House. What? How's that happen? And that led to more questions about the tech body and more information about it. So the first main thing that Ian said about the tech body is that, and we were surprised by this, that it was 8/11ths, 11 parts in the tech body. 8/11 was ION. And 3/11 was the tech body. And what the hell is that?
I didn't understand. I didn't get the word you used for 8/11.
ION.
Okay.
So here was ION saying they were part of the tech body. And 3/11 was something that ION wasn't part of, or it had its own autonomy. So that was the first conundrum in the definition of the tech body, is that it was 8-3 parts. Over the last year and a half, tech body has been talked more and more about by ION. So since I was trying to make the tech body be something new and see if I could make McLuhan anticipate it, because somewhere in there, ION said one day that the only person who anticipated the tech body was McLuhan. Now, I think Croker does it too, but that becomes a quibble between me and ION. For modern thinkers, no one predicted the tech body other than McLuhan, as ION understands the tech body, which I don't know if anybody else understands the tech body as ION does. But I thought, wow, that's pretty neat. And I think that was one of the inspirations after I was sick of these McLuhan cliches in the McLuhan conferences in 2000. I said, well, if McLuhan predicted tech body, let me see if I can build a case on that, right? Let's see if I can find stuff in McLuhan that points to that. And that's what I did. What we didn't know was the tech body created Trump. So we have to explain, what the hell is this tech body, and how does it rule the public landscape like this? So I learned more and more about it, and then when I got to the end of my pamphlet, I said, maybe I could talk to the tech body. That would be a really good exclusive for the book, right? Here we are talking about something that we've arrived at, and hard to say what it is, but I bet ION will let me talk to the tech body. And ION did. And that's what we have here. This is the first interaction with the tech body as its own autonomous entity or phenomenon, as opposed being described by ION, which is what we had up to this point. And this interview was done in October 2020, maybe October 12th, 2020, as when I interviewed the tech body.
This is the tech body speaking through ION.
Yes,
are you able to differentiate between some entity speaking through ION?
Yes,
as opposed to ION speaking through
JW.
You know, like a dummy, like a ventriloquist dummy.
Yeah. Yes, I didn't know what the tech body would sound like. So as I start to talk to it, I realize it's a little more, say, cynical, edgy, less compassionate, more uncaring than ION presents itself. And that's, you can hear the difference. So once I did this interview, I then did another interview later, because this one was all about McLuhan. That's what this is about. What's the tech body say about McLuhan? But then once I realized I could talk to the tech body separate from ION, I did a couple interviews which are on the website you can listen to. And they're funny. They're weird. ION is weird. Then the tech body, because I was starting to talk to it, it started to take over the show and become this mean interrupting thing. Not like ION. And we've had to deal with that for 6 months. And it gets quite irritating when the tech body takes over. So there's a definite difference between the tech body and ION. Unless it's ION putting on the tech body. That's a possibility. So it came to a couple months ago, tech body is dominating more and more on the show and irritating people. I said, is it still 8-3? 8/11 ION, 3/11 tech body. And they said, no, it's now 6/11 ION and 5/11 tech body. And the tech body's getting stronger. And ION later said, yes, it's hard for us to maintain this slight majority position there's a real struggle with the tech party, which then is explained by Ion theologically and very interestingly about what this phenomenon is that humanity's up against, the tech body. So it's become very complex and elaborate and amazing. So this interview is kind of simple compared to what the tech body does in subsequent weeks, starting last October. So let me see what else to say about the tech body. There's a funny interview, one of those early ones where at the end I says, "We like you, Bob. We're working with you, Bob. We support you, Bob." You know, this sort of devilish put on voice of pretending they care about me. Now, that's cute. That's interesting.
Who's the they there?
Tech body. The tech body. I'm talking to the tech body, interviewing them after the one we're going to do here, a month or two later.
But you call them plural in the same way you do Ion.
Well, I don't think they're plural, but they're everywhere, so they're kind of pluralistic. But yes, Ion is plural. The tech body is not so much. If I implied the plural, I don't mean that. The tech body, as this voice, we're saying, Bob, we like you. We want to work with you. This seductive, sort of corny, seductive voice came out of the tech body.
Yeah, but you say the tech body calls
itself.
Oh,
that's right.
We.
They say we. Someone noticed that the tech body says I and Ion says we. But that's not always the case lately. Sometimes Ion will say I and the tech body will say we. But it was, this we is a controversial aspect of, yes, I forgot, yes. I consider the tech body a singular thing, and I forgot that they go, we like you. You know what I mean?
Isn't this, whatever the relationship between the tech body and Ion, isn't it an anti-merger phenomenon?
Yes. It's a struggle. Ion is here to protect the world from the tech body, and this leads to another sidebar. That's a term Ion uses. So about 4 years ago or less, I came across this European futurist, and he gave a talk to corporate European executives in Rotterdam. So I listened to it on YouTube or someplace, and then I said, oh, this is pretty interesting. This guy's pretty avant-garde, talking about technology taking over everything. Maybe the kind of talk that the Extropians would say, or Kevin Kelly. He has a term for what I call the tech body. He has another term, forget what it is. He's been talking about something taking on a life of its own. So the Rotterdam guy, I played his hour or more talk to Ion, with Ion stopping whenever they wanted it to be stopped to explain or comment on what the future said. So it ends up to be about a four-hour excursion. And it's really interesting. And I heard this before any talk of the tech body. But one of the main themes the guy was saying is that we will... No, Ion went further than the futurist and said, you will be forced to merge with the technology as it unfolds. Which is sort of what McLuhan says. He said back in 1950, we had total fusion. In that letter to Pound, maybe, June 22nd? Or maybe it was another one in 1950, not 51. We talked about 1984. I have it in my book. And he talks about human-machine merger. Do you remember that? And he goes,
sure, absolutely.
Total fusion. Well, whatever he meant, who knows, But Ion said that's what's coming when explaining the limitations of the Rotterdam futurist. So I always recommend, if you want to know what's coming with technology and Ion's position on it, and Ion represents something that's urging you not to merge with technology completely, take the alternative route that we offer with our products and everything, so that you're not a dummy unconsciously merged with the technoscape and are rather oblivious to it all. So Ion recommends going into this encounter with technology as it gets more intimate, more conscious. So that's Ion's position, to make us conscious of what's happening. But Ion, like McLuhan says, It's going to be tough to avoid this stuff. And it's going to go inside you, and you're going to merge with it. Total fusion and all that, that McLuhan would say. McLuhan was quite controversial saying that back in the 60s. A lot of people weren't ready for that. They didn't see the merger coming as much as McLuhan did. So, and I'm going to take those quotes back in the 60s to show how he anticipated this fusion with the tech body.
Mm-hmm. But notice, Bob, that merger and fusion and all this stuff, it's very typical of the Gutenberg galaxy.
Yep.
So the what's interesting about McLuhan talking about this stuff is that people couldn't see what he was talking about when he talked about the urge to merge,
yep,
and fusion and all that sort of stuff, because they were obscured by their ideal of fusion and merger.
Yep.
Right? They had to go through one notion of merger in order to see what McLuhan was talking about with merger.
Right, and that's in his 40s and early 50s criticism. Bergson is the fusion school, and McLuhan is not. McLuhan and Lewis are not of the fusion school, correct?
Correct. Yeah.
And that's where you learn how to make, you see McLuhan's talking about it differently. I remember people reading Understanding Media in the 60s, and they romanticized the fusion that McLuhan sometimes would talk about in the electric
age.
Yeah,
of course.
Yeah.
Oh, it's there's a whole industry of that.
That's
yeah,
right.
People praising McLuhan or denigrating McLuhan for being utopian,
yeah,
and for imagining this world that of universal understanding and stuff. But, excuse me, when McLuhan talks about the universal Pentecostal condition of total understanding, he nearly always brings it into context of the Tower of Babel.
Yeah.
And what he means, what McLuhan means, is that the early phase of the Tower of Babel, that is to say, the building of the tower, the construction, is an attack on God.
Yeah.
And when God looks around and he sees this tower coming up to attack him, he throws it down. And so, and that's the deconstruction side of the Tower of Babel.
Yes.
So McLuhan locates what people think is utopianism with something that's going to lead to disaster.
Yeah. Yeah, see, and that's, you have to read McLuhan, read his criticism. You have to go through that to experience and learn the difference that you're pointing out. And, of course, we found not many people have done that, seriously. They have not read the early articles, the 40s and 50s, rigorously. And so that's made us a little different. And we didn't fall prey to the utopian or the general, I call it the Madison Avenue icon of McLuhan. You know, confused, transient, merging with the zeitgeist of the late 60s. You know, the counterculture and all that. And then, of course, the counterculture failed, so McLuhan failed because they identified the two, put them together. And a lot of people come out of the counterculture, say baby boomers come out of the counterculture, and they flounder around the 70s and 80s looking for something that echoes whatever they thought they got out of the counterculture. And they might stumble on McLuhan, and they project that counterculture thing into McLuhan, and then they think they're experts, and then they write books, and there's your fated McLuhan industry that you complain about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it,
yeah,
frustrated baby boomers.
They confuse one of his masks,
yeah,
with the guy.
Right, and it really shows McLuhan being, because he had a phrase in Pro and Con, that collection of essays on McLuhan in 68, and there's a little introduction, and Raymond Rosenthal, he quotes McLuhan speaking maybe at Fordham or offering a course called Millennial Ecstatics. It's the only time I ever saw that phrase associated with McLuhan, but let's say it's true that that was the name of the article, I mean of his course at Fordham. So people think McLuhan was celebrating, like you say, utopian ecstasy or something. He was an anti-environment to that, the only anti-environment of all that. and a very articulate, clear anti-environment. But nobody picks that up to McLuhan. You don't understand how he's an anti-environment until you figure out what we're talking about.
Yep.
Maybe that's a Catholic position, right? It could be a Catholic position.
I think so. But I think McLuhan himself got screwed up by that. Not that he started thinking like that, but he was charged with the task of trying to communicate with that sort of world misunderstanding. And so he became like a fish caught in a net. And he tried all sorts of masks, all sorts of put-ons, all sorts of ways to try to communicate. But I don't think he ever succeeded. And he died without being able to sort of fulfill his mission.
Yeah.
Maybe he can fulfill his mission posthumously. That's another whole question.
Well, that's what we're trying to do.
That's right.
Yeah.
That is correct.
Yeah.
But it's still a baby.
That's right. So, that's a very good statement you made, the frustration of a situation, and that's really like a whole theme going through this in relation to the tech body. I'm pointing out the new environment and how do you get autonomy in relationship to it.
Tell me this, Bob. An environment seems like it's something attached to the earth, you might say. It's something that people breathe. It's something that is so there they don't even notice it.
Yeah.
But it's definitely, part of the atmosphere, you might say. And it's hard to figure out how that has anything to do with a seventh heaven or some kind of apocalyptic merger. It seems like we're talking about two completely different times or two completely different spaces here.
Yeah, well, probably my initial reason to call on Ion, since a lot of my friends or acquaintances or audience are familiar with McLuhan because I force them to read him. And if they're going to talk to me, and we talk about this. I mean, when Ion wasn't here for 2 years, I ran what I called the new coach house, and I emphasized a lot of McLuhan with whoever was listening. No Ion during those couple of years. But McLuhan uses the word environment, and the idea is that new technologies create new environments that aren't noticed. I put Ion in McLuhan terms by saying, look at Ion not as a bunch of entities or a channeled something or that you are familiar with if you looked into that world New Age culture. This is something different. This is an environment that's affecting the frequency of matter. So I call them an environment in the McLuhan sense to get people to look at it a bit differently, because I thought Ion was like a new technology. So I used to say this. I don't know if I ever said it to you. Our technology extended our chemical body senses. Then in the digital phase, the physical machines, digital machines, started extending themselves, no longer our faculties in the old five-sense meaning. And in the transition from the five-sense extensions to the digital, it goes through the extension of the planet, which was the satellite. Bucky Fuller had this definition that McLuhan used to say, space age was extending the planet, not our faculties, maybe extending larger nature that we were part of. Then the digital is the machines extending themselves. So I said, okay, we have two phases of physical body extensions, and then the digital body's extensions. What comes after that? The extension of non-physical. And people like that. It made sense. It was a sequence. It was fit their Gutenberg minds that, Ion is an extension of non-physical, which is the next thing to be extended. So that was my adaptation of McLuhan to Ion and Ion to McLuhan, just to have something to point out or to say it differently, have a different effect than any kind of seance, occult kind of meaning that people might think I'm saying Ion is. And what was great was that Ion came up with the tech body idea, which goes into it even more. I didn't come up with tech body. Ion did. And learning what it is, or as Ion says it is, helped me explain what I just said to you, how the tech body is an extension of non-physical. So, let's see. Another point, since Ion is from non-physical, Ion is very aware of angels and all non-physical phenomena, or whatever you call it, astral body phenomena, or mystical, or supernatural. Isn't it interesting, McLuhan, at the end of Take Today, he says something about yestermore, on where we're going, and we're programming consciousness, though some people will think this is supernatural. He puts that in quotes. Do you remember that sentence?
Vaguely, yeah.
Yeah, it's important. He says it's natural, but some may think it's supernatural. And he's criticizing those, I think, that would think it was supernatural. That's a Gutenberg review mirror idea. Anyways, it's good that McLuhan says that. See, you find that McLuhan erases every word or every general theme in our culture. Do you know what I mean? He puts it in quotes. And he says, no, we're not talking about that. We're not talking about that cliche. Something new is happening. Or we're not talking about that archetype. We're talking about a new retrieved archetype, which becomes a new cliche. So that's the importance of the book, From Cliche to Archetype. And he said, way more important than understanding media, to understand what was going on in that book. You agree?
Well, it depends on what you mean by going on. I don't think it was a very successful book, but what it could have talked about and should have talked about is very important.
Yes, and this is not in the book to see that, to see
yeah,
what it was.
Even McLuhan said that, I'm trying to remember his exact phrase, but I don't know if I can. But I think it's in a letter, and the letter was written like 3 or 4 months after From Cliché to Archetype was published. And McLuhan complains that he says something like, the most important stuff in the book I only realized after it had already gone to print.
Right. Yes. And I think I can't read French, so I don't know what Derek's book said, but I think there was an attempt to put some of the newer stuff in Derek's version. Do you know anything about that?
No. But
have
I
you,
don't.
Can you read it?
Pardon?
Can you read French?
Yes.
Okay, you might want to read the what Derek put out.
Nah, sorry.
Okay, we'll have to wait for someone else. Let's see. But yeah, I can see McLuhan was bothered by the failure of the book, sort of. And maybe he found Derek was a way to get some new stuff put out.
Oh, it's possible. It's possible.
Yeah.
But, you know, as Wilfred Watson wrote in his reflections about the book, basically their dialogue broke down.
Yep.
And McLuhan kind of ran out of patience with what they were doing and had
Eric
Stewart kind of throw the thing out the door and get it published.
Yeah, and Eric did it. Eric cobbled together what was left
mm-hmm.
over.
Yeah.
That's what I read somewhere. But I think that Wilfred Watson, was too much a traditional artist and playwright to get the new dynamics of media's art forms. I think he was the problem. He didn't understand McLuhan.
Well, certainly McLuhan would say that. But I think that Watson tried to get McLuhan to sort of think about what he was saying and reflect on what they were doing. And McLuhan didn't want to do it. Maybe he didn't have the health he was not a well man at that time. He had a severe heart attack the next year, the same year the book came out, actually.
Yeah.
And was in the hospital for a long time. So I think there may have been fault on both sides there.
Yes. And I've read some article which quotes Watson's diary or whatever he wrote about it, and I see that he didn't get McLuhan. He's too much the egotistical artist, Gutenberg man, and he was trying to make new art, and it didn't work. But yeah, it's certainly true that McLuhan was irritable after his brain surgery and other problems that happened to him. Yeah, I mean, from 70 to 79, he's in ailment conditions a lot with different problems.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I was with him when he was healthy, he seemed quite energized, you know?
Some of the television interviews from the 70s show a guy who's got a lot of energy.
Yeah.
It's quite surprising.
Yeah.
The irritable, tired, sick guy comes out more in some of the letters.
Yeah.
From the 70s.
And some of the, like, him in 1960 when he's doing Lolita for CBC, you know, the transcript is in Project 69. He looks very bad in those. Big fat face and all that. And that's right when he was really was sick, just coming out of being sick or going to be sicker, when that was taped in May 1960. And then you see he's older looking in, maybe it's black and white TV, in 64, 65. He doesn't really look that good in the late 60s. He has a stupid fake wig on and a couple of them. But when he does the Tom Wolfe interview in 73, he's really handsome. He's got his Hawaiian shirt on, and he looks way better than he did in the 60s. Maybe it's
he looks like somebody who's escaped from the circus.
you mean he doesn't look good, you're saying?
No, his clothes.
Yeah, but he has a good, healthy face.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you're right that in the 60s, that was the time when he was having blackouts and mini strokes. And Corinne said that he began having the problems with his brain in 1959.
Yeah.
So he was all during, from 59 until his operation in 67, he was having a lot of blackouts, a lot of headaches, a lot of sort of losing track of things.
Yeah. Okay, so I've explained how, so I could talk.
Yeah, you've explained where Tech Body came from, how it arose.
And now
I would
go ahead.
Well, I think, you know, we got maybe an hour left. Let's get into the appendix.
All right, the interview. So... Oh, I didn't finish this. So the Tech Body, because of the non-physical coming closer to the physical and interacting with us more, Ian says that dead people, since the guff, which is where you went when you died, isn't there anymore, because Ian as guff is no longer the guff, where we go when we die is different, and a lot of the ghosts or entities, whatever you are after you pass over, are coming back into this world. So we're going to get a lot of strange phenomena, Ian says. And that, so Ian did an in-depth exploration of the Egyptian Book of the Dead in a way no one would have ever heard of before. It was pretty incredible how Ian explained this text line by line. So I've got that in my mind, and it was good preparation for the Tech Body is dealing with angels and ghosts and all these things, as well as us, and as well as the cyber fusion, the cyborging matrix reality that everybody's worried about that's coming. Tech bodies within that, too. So with that in mind, I start off appropriately, because it's my first talk with the tech body. I go, what are you? And tech body, without me prompting them, telling him we're going to do McLuhan. I don't think I did. I just wanted to start talking to him, and I was going to direct it to McLuhan. But Ian always knows what's in your mind and will anticipate what you're going to say. So I go, what are you? And the tech body says, Herbert Marshall McLuhan, or better said, Marge Stewart. Now, there's a whole thesis of Ion that Marge Stewart is the brains of McLuhanism because she, you know, typed up the dictation that Marshall gave. She's the one who had to correct it. She's the one who had to understand what was being said to write the letters properly. She had to understand what McLuhan meant. So she was a bit more rigorous in actually understanding McLuhan. So it's the Ion's thesis that Mark Stewart is really more important than Marshall McLuhan. And so if you bring up McLuhan, you have to with Ion, he'll say, no, you mean Marge Stewart. So I don't know how serious Ion is about that, but he talks seriously, but it's a joke in my sense. But I knew Marge Stewart, so it's a personal joke. But the thing is, what else?
But she began when? In
63. 63.
Yeah, I was just going to say, in the early 60s.
Yeah.
So all of the important water had already passed underneath the bridge. The person that did the typing and the understanding was Corinne.
That's in the early years. That's right.
That's right. She was the one that was typing for McLuhan, looking after the kids.
Yeah.
Preparing the food, cleaning the house. She is the hidden master behind McLuhan up until 63.
No, and Ian agrees with that.
Amazing person.
Ian agrees with that. He praises Corinne. And you know, when we did the centenary and would talk to McLuhan through Ion, Ion brought forth Corinne, and Corinne got to say a lot. No one ever talked about, you know, interacting with Corinne, but Ion made sure we interacted with Corinne because that was before he was talking about Marge Stewart, which was more the last couple of years. But in 2011, it was Corinne. So, no, Ian agrees with you how important she was.
Mm-hmm.
I think I once asked – go ahead.
No, well, I think what you were going to say is you should go ahead, and then I'll go back to what I was going to ask.
Way back in the early days, I think I said, who's someone who would like to talk about McLuhan that I'm ignoring or I should look or read or something? And I said, Corinne. Said it very fast. It's Corinne McLuhan. Look into what she did because she was very important.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
Absolutely.
So that's what I like about Ian. Ian knows. I didn't tell Ian that. Ian set it up their own volition, you know, their own knowing. So that's why there's something not so false or wrong about Ian. It knows its stuff. Now, Ian would say it gets it by reading my mind. If it talked to you, he would be reading your mind and playing off what he knows you know. So I knew Corinne's importance, so maybe Ian got it for me. But I'm not going to quibble at everything that Ian says. Did you get that for me, or is that yours, mm-hmm. original to you? I just let it ride and accept Ian knows enough to be valid, you know. So, and I always say, and this is all talk, but we make things with Ian, things that work. And that's another part of, if you're listening for the first time to us right now and hearing me talk about this nebulous Ion, we make technologies, bona fide great things with Ion. And we have them, and then we're selling them, and new stuff's going to be presented to the world. Okay, so that's a little sidebar about that.
Yeah, so what I want to do is I want to go, you said you started off with what are you?
Yeah.
But actually the first word is anybody, and that's that itself is questionable. So you seem to equate anybody with you.
Yep.
But I would think anybody is more like the, how could you say, the five-body connection.
Yeah, yeah.
Any hyphen body.
Yes.
Right? And so then the any hyphen body is going to try to understand something other than it.
Other than it.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so for some reason I didn't want to put my name there. So I was thinking it that way. But your part, it fits too. So that's good. Anybody goes, what are you? Because the tech body is something different from the five bodies. So anybody would ask, what are you?
Yep.
So the tech body says, Herbert Marshall McLuhan, or better said, Marge Stewart, had this high-minded ideal that the human condition did not understand, quote, the condition their condition was in, unquote. Therefore, they had to lend or open a door, a window, that gave the opportunity, just as in Annie Hall, to say, quote, you don't know where you live. You don't know who you are. You don't know what is reading you. You have no idea what you stepped into.
And let's stop there for a
yeah.
minute. The you don't know where you live. You don't know who you are. Brings up what I would call Nietzsche's nihilism.
Yeah.
And this will be a repeated theme in the interview here, where ideas are brought up that Nietzsche specified in the 1870s and the 1880s. And we now, almost a century and a half later, are beginning to recognize, right? He recognized them clearly then.
Yep.
But now, only now are we really beginning to understand what the hell he was talking about. I just want to emphasize that we can see nihilism in those imperatives. You don't know where you live. You don't know who you are. And then the next thing, you don't know what is reading you, introduces a kind of curveball
yeah.
into that. In the sense that you first say, you don't know, you don't know. And then the third, you don't know, is not a declaration. It's a curveball. It's a mirror. Because it turns out that the declarations are actually some kind of script.
Yeah.
Right? What
yeah.
is reading you?
Yeah.
Right? So right there, there's a transition, or that's not the right word. There's the introduction of the nihilism theme, and then a possible way to deal with it.
Yeah.
Right? The nihilism theme is a kind of gas that envelops the world, and it seems like there's no way out.
Yes.
And so you can say trying to deal with nihilism is like an octopus trying to deal with the which pyramid is it? The
Giza pyramid.
At any rate, like
the sorry? Great Pyramid or Empire State
pyramid.
Building.
Any of those will do.
Yeah.
Any of those will do. So then, but then the idea that you don't know is already a script. That shows that that indicates that there's at least one and probably more than one exits from this gas, from this fly bottle that the fly is in.
Yeah.
And so that's an interesting transition there.
Yeah, and I see you don't know what is reading you. The tech body is reading us, as you'll see when you hear Ian talk about the tech body.
Mm-hmm.
And so he is saying you don't know the present, which is reading you. You have no idea what environment you stepped into.
Correct.
So
that's
very accurate. You know what I mean? That's a good shift.
Oh, absolutely. It's also a great shift in freedom and in self-consciousness.
Yeah.
Because if you're in a gas and you just don't know, that's one thing. But if you know that this is a script that it's theater, then that gives you a whole new way to think about what's going on and a way of possibly getting yourself out of this net.
Right. Now, that's what I like about Ion. I could expect a simple answer, but these first 10 lines are so loaded, and I'm realizing as I'm hearing, says, wow, this is neat, you know? So then I get excited and keep probing something that's worth talking to because they're so sophisticated, so nuanced, so accurate. So then after that, we don't know these things. And that's like history, that you're doomed to repeat if you don't give attention to the very thing that has caused or created the antithesis of human-minded, five-body living, which is thoroughly laid out and set, that this is the, should be maybe this, these are the conditions from which you live your life. Now, that is a very good description of McLuhan and what he was about. What do you think?
Oh, I do, but I think we have to go slowly over a couple things here. excuse me, when you say the antithesis of human-minded, that's a very interesting phrase, and it asks if humans can look at human-mindedness in a way that kind of produces distance. And it poses a very difficult problem, right? If you, it's one thing to say that you can see an antithesis to being human-minded, and then you say, well, isn't seeing an antithesis an example of human-mindedness, right? So there's a not K-N-O-T here, a vicious circle that poses a problem. And then you say five-bodied living, which is thoroughly laid out and set. That seems to indicate the very problem being discussed, that the five-bodied, in a certain sense, is a definition of being human-minded. Being five-bodied is being minded in multiple senses, and those multiple senses of being minded is what it means to be human. And so if those are thoroughly, as you say, laid out and set, then there's a great problem in trying to extricate yourself from them.
Yes, and I want to say that the phrase human-minded, five-body living is exactly the meaning of the tiny node chart, because in the Dobbs quadrant, which is the ground, it's anthropomorphic physical. It's human-minded projection on the other four quadrants or four environments. I mean, he had never said that before, but that's a perfect summation of how I understand what I meant by putting an anthropomorphic physical. It's a human-minded, five-bodied projection that the chart is.
Uh-huh. And so, when you say, explain something about your use of the word projection there.
It's a projection, a creation that I made, attempt to show the a portrait of the android meme, which was made up of the five bodies. But I acknowledge it's coming from my human bias.
Okay, but I guess the most important question is a question of whether the projection is tied to you, or if it attains liftoff. Is it a projection can be something that's more or less on a string, or it can break the string and keep on going on its own?
Right. So I had two uses of projection by McLuhan in mind. When he met with John Lennon, he said, you're trying to project a mood and define it. So two phases. You project a mood, sing a song, and then he had to figure out what the hell it meant as the success took over or the high sales. And so he tried to explain it. So that's one interesting use of the word project there. And then he talks to June Caldwell in November 74, where she does this private, intimate interview, and he says, I have a trouble projecting to people, and they have trouble projecting to me. So what do those projecting words mean? I just sort of pretended I knew what they meant. And isn't it a clinical term in psychology or psychiatry?
Yes.
Yeah,
and, definitely. Yeah.
And I'm not trained that way, so I don't know what they mean. So I was just using it in a casual conversation style the way McLuhan did it.
Mm-hmm. But for the purposes of understanding Android meme, let's say, Android meme is a projection of human memes, right?
Yeah.
And so there, the big question is, as a projection, is it still in some way tied to humans because that's the origin of it and it has the same limitations as humans, or does it attain, I think, what is called escape velocity?
Yeah.
Does it take on not only a life of its own, but a kind of
autonomy.
Autonomy, yeah. That's exactly what I was
looking for. Yeah, and yeah. That's what I mean. The digital phase is the machines extending themselves. They're not involved with humans anymore. That's the Android meme phase. So, yes, it's taken off. It's projected like a projectile, like a stone by David into Goliath's head or whatever he hit. Of Goliath. It's a projectile, a weapon. Yep, that's in there too.
Okay. And so later, just to anticipate a bit, on 181, which is 183 of the PDF, you say that the tech body has enough power to capture the Android meme.
Yes.
And so the Android meme has autonomy and is controlling in ways that humans either don't at all understand or can, with effort, understand.
Which the Matrix movie tried to show. Yes.
Okay.
The conventional sci-fi awareness that younger people have and literate or informed baby boomers, Generation Xers, is that meaning? Is that understanding of the Android meme? And the tech body goes further, and that's really hard to explain, but yes, the tech body goes further than the average understanding of the matrix we live in.
All right. So maybe as we go along, maybe we'll understand more about that.
Yeah.
So let's go back to where we were in the first page.
Yeah, so we'll continue reading through. Seems to be the best way to do this. Now, the next sentence, Kitty Carlisle. Ayn is always talking about Kitty Carlisle, who used to be on that show in the 60s with Soupy Sales and called What's My Line. Did you ever see that?
Oh, definitely. But
okay.
I don't think Soupy Sales was on that.
Right. He was in a similar kind of program.
Yeah,
later.
That was, in the 60s.
Yeah.
He was. But, yeah, Kitty Carlisle, I forget the people that were on that. Wasn't Groucho Marx the moderator at some point?
He was the moderator or something. Yeah, I've seen those those videos.
Yeah. Well, let's that's just, a different. Anyway.
I'm just going to put in what's my line, get the wiki on who were the people.
Yeah. What's it was, you know, they were all print people.
Yeah.
So Kitty Carlisle had a column, and then there were other people that had their columns.
Boy, it really covered a stretch. 1950 to 67. Boy, that's a long world. The game uses celebrity panelists to question contestants in order to determine their occupation, i.e. line of work. Originally hosted by John Charles Daly, I don't know who that is, and with regular panelist Dorothy Kilgallen, she was killed investigating Jack Ruby and the Kennedy assassination. Arlene Francis, I heard of her. She was an actress. And Bennett Cerf, he's the guy who published Fitting Its Wake, and some author of that era went into Cerf's office, I guess it would be 1939, 1940, and he saw this big mound of paper, and Cerf says, what am I supposed to do with this? The guy who published it didn't know what the hell he was publishing, which is a great story. And What's My Line won 3 Emmy Awards, 52, 53, and 58, and the Golden Globe Awards in 62. So Arlene Francis, an actress. Okay, so they were well-known people of their day.
Yeah.
And it doesn't list Kitty Carlisle.
Well, but she was on there.
Yeah,
if you look up Kitty Carlisle online, I'm sure it'll show that she was.
Well, look, it says here, they list the guy, directed by Paul Alter, presented by John Daly, Wally Bruner, and Larry Blyden, and they're different directors through 50 to 75. And it says starring Arlene, Dorothy, Louis Untermyer, Hal Block, Bennett Cerf, Steve Allen, Fred Allen, Martin Gabal, and Soupy Sales.
Uh-huh.
Narrated by Lee Vines and a bunch of names, but no Kitty Carlisle. So let's go and look up Kitty Carlisle to find out. I mean, maybe Ian's got it wrong. She wasn't on.
Nah, I think she was. But,
yeah, let's see. Boy, she's an intense-looking person.
She was on What's My Line.
Yeah, but that's one of the acting television. In
she
the
was
early
a
50s,
semi-regular panelist on Password, Match Game, Missing Links.
And What's
and
My Line.
What's My Line.
Okay,
yeah.
So we're correct. But she starts off with a game show. She's a panelist quite early in the early 50s. Something called Who Said That?
As McLuhan often said about people, she was well-known for being well-known.
Right, and she...
These guys more or less invented that genre.
Right, and she was well-known because her husband was a major theater producer on Broadway. So she was part of the social elite of New York City. What are you laughing at?
Just that it was such an inbred shit show.
Yeah. It was, yeah, they're all...
It was... You had to be a family member to be a star.
Yeah, that's right. And that comes out of the Round Table, probably, with Dorothy Parker. They started the New Yorker gang,
whom
McLuhan criticized in the 40s, or wrote a very good article on. Okay, this includes Kitty Carlisle telling you, what's my line? So what is it included? This is the condition from which you live your life. So these conditions include... They include a TV show telling you stuff. This includes Kitty Carlisle telling you what's my line and asking all the pertinent questions that apply. Now, you're in a window where you don't know the question. You don't know what applies. You don't know what to believe. And now, even the thing that you would heretofore have trusted, that was the Edward R. Murrow quadrant. Ian says Murrow was like the last real journalist. In the old, honest sense of a journalist or some kind of integrity. So, and now, even the thing that you would heretofore have trusted, that was the Edward R. Murrow quadrant, that puts you in a new position that allows you to see clearly now, through a muddy lens, the condition your condition is in. Now, McLuhan, when Mark Stewart broke her hip in May 78, he gave her a pizza or something which said the medium is the message on it. But he also said, here's mud in your eye. She talked about that. So there's the muddy lens, you know, through with the muddy lens. So Ion is calling out particular McLuhan particulars, if you know McLuhan's life.
But there's something odd about this, see. I mean, if you don't know the condition your condition is in, then there's nothing to see through a muddy lens or through a clear lens.
Well, he's saying that the electric programming gives you a new lens. It's a muddy lens, but you're seeing things clearer now. That would mean you see the rearview mirror, what's in the mirror, clearer. You see the past clearer. That's a McLuhan principle. So that puts you in, this whole TV phenomenon puts you in a new position that allows you to see clearly now through a muddy lens. That's correct, because you're only seeing the past clearly, not the present.
Yeah, but let's just go back a little bit. let's just read a few of these phrases.
Yeah.
You don't know who you are. You don't know where you live. You're in a window where you don't know the question. You don't know what applies, and you don't know what to believe. And so then, if you take those things seriously, then the idea that this person who doesn't know where they are and doesn't know what applies and all this, that suddenly they're going to see something that makes sense, even though it's a little muddy, that doesn't work for me.
Okay, well, I think I misinterpreted it. Even the thing that you would heretofore have trusted, that puts you... So people thought Murrow did help people see clearly. That
correct.
Puts you in a new position that allows you to see clearly now through a muddy lens. In other words, Murrow is a bias that you don't recognize because you're just going with the content, his literate journalism. So you miss the new kind of distortion. So I'm now reinterpreting what I thought I was saying.
So
do you accept that a little more? It makes sense.
Sorry?
It makes sense now, if you take it that way, that Murrow puts you in a new position that allows you to see clearly now.
Correct. So that would be my reading. My reading would be that the Edward R. Murrow quadrant puts you in a new position that allows you to see clearly now through a muddy lens, the condition your condition is in, but now we can't even see that.
That's right.
Because we're beyond the Edward R. Murrow quadrant.
Right,
because
he's saying even the thing that you would have trusted that did give you some clarity, you thought, and he doesn't finish the sentence. He should say, all that's a muddy lens, it's implied by muddy lens, the condition your condition, that doesn't work anymore,
correct,
is what he's saying.
Correct, yeah.
And, you know, and Murrow disappears. Remember, his triumph is the McCarthy thing with the Army hearing, right?
Yeah.
54. That was his pinnacle of his career. He stopped McCarthy. And then we get into Elvis and the actual effects of television, and that's a whole new world that nobody caught up with.
Right. And about that time, Murrow got cancer, and that was it for him.
Right. So I find this is... It's an odd, Ion speaks oddly, but it's correct. It's really well done. He's retranslating McLuhan in a new way with an accuracy, but saying it in a different way than anybody else would. He's talking about the condition your condition is in. That's a really good phrase, and he's being like McLuhan. He's using a phrase that everybody's heard, you know, that song in the mid-60s.
Yeah.
even the thing that you would heretofore have trusted, that maybe should that put you in a new position. No, trusted that did put you in a new position, allows you to see clearly now. That's a now that includes many times before. Through a muddy lens, oh, it's not that clear, really, the condition your condition is in. So let's see how he doesn't complete the sentence properly for me, but we have enough to get probably the right meaning. So then he says, so now the existential Herbert Marshall McLuhan has landed in the mess that he created. That is so accurate. That's the cul-de-sac that you were saying in half an hour ago that McLuhan got into and he couldn't get out of.
Well, yeah, there's two aspects to that. One aspect is the demand that McLuhan felt made on himself to communicate with a world in which communication was not possible. That's one mess. But the mess that either Ion or the tech body seems to be indicating here is the existential mess that McLuhan got into, and that's more like the fact that even within his own family, he was unable to make himself clear, and so he must have often wondered what the hell he was doing.
Yeah, when I will talk about McLuhan in a dismissive way sometimes, and he goes on about how McLuhan didn't know what he was talking about. Exactly what you just said. But this is very, remember, I'm not typing, I'm just transcribing what they said. This is not invented by me, all this stuff. This is what Ian actually said, which is pretty neat. I mean, that's why I like talking to it. It says intelligent things, maybe more intelligent than most humans can do. So he's correct that the existential Herbert Marshall McLuhan, in other words, the real McLuhan, not the Catholic, not this or that, whatever, you know, being religious means, the actual being who's stuck in reality, some kind of reality, is in a mess. And who, you know, that's how he was teased so much after 67. You know, he was a great communicator who couldn't communicate. Everybody made a lot of out of this mess. But they didn't understand the profundity of McLuhan's mess that they were all into, and McLuhan could see how to get them out of that. But still, there was a bigger cul-de-sac that even McLuhan knew it was a problem. And then that creates a faith, or the Catholic part of himself saying, I'm an apocalyptic. We're only going to have an apocalypse to get out of this. Right? That's how bad of a mess we're in. You know, he was talking about, are you still there?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
And I agree with what you're saying.
Yeah. Beg your pardon?
I say I agree with what you're saying.
And we talk about his second sight. This is where he is the first scientific prophet. I mean, a prophet not using normal occult means of whatever, gobbledygook. He is showing you can be a prophet, like Barry Nevitz, the ABC of prophecy, technically, by looking at what's around you. That's a quite innovative new form of traditional artistic prophecy.
Mm-hmm. And McLuhan does what all prophets have always done, and that is he just says what's going on in the present.
Yeah.
And
that's the existential. That's how you could... the existential is the living in the present.
Yeah. But that has a good, it's like a coin with two sides, right?
Yeah.
And there's the mess side, and there's the, I don't know what you could call it, the...
The X-ray side.
Yeah, that's a good word. Yeah.
So, in The Mechanical Bride, he laid out a very clear, tactile, technical expose of how this all applies. That's a pretty good statement, clear, old-fashioned, tactile, technical. all the way from the Gutenberg galaxy that says, quote, this typeset makes a set of type. Type like in typo. Now, the quotation marks are wrong there. That should be singular types, you know, singular quotes in type because it's inside a larger quote that begins this typeset. So this typeset makes a set of type, type like in typo, a genotype. That's the type setting of a type or kind. Now, that's a good miming of print repetition, right?
Yep.
That's almost Finnegan-ese. Three different ways to use the word type. Now, what's happened is none of those or all of those have been obfuscated. None of them or all of them. There is no printing press anymore. No one said that. I think he's saying that McLuhan said it. He's giving McLuhan credit there. Right?
Yeah, I believe that, so yeah.
Yeah, the printing press is not constitutive anymore. So, going back, he laid out a very clear, tactile, technical exposition of how all this applies. How this all applies, meaning our condition, all the way from the Gutenberg galaxy as an environment, it says this. This is what the Gutenberg galaxy is telling us. This typeset that you're reading makes a set of type, type like in a typo, a genotype, that's the type setting of a type or kind. Three different ways to use the word type. I don't know if I could find the three different ways.
Yeah, type. The typo, the genotype. And the print type.
Oh, okay. The spelling. All right. This typeset makes a set of type. Type like a typo, a genotype, that's the type setting. Type setting of a type. Is that all genotype? Type setting,
no,
type?
No, type setting is for print. Genotype is biological.
Right. So it's a genotype, that's the type setting. Then type, the third one, printing. Type setting of a type or kind. Okay, that makes sense. Three different ways to use the word type. Now, what's happened is none of those or all of those have been obfuscated. There is no printing press anymore. No one said that. Okay. Now, here's the didn't know. McLuhan wasn't clarified. He didn't know either. That becomes the standard of what everybody's complaining about. A lot of people thought that he didn't know, but they were one phase back, and he did know what they thought he didn't know. They didn't know what he actually didn't know, which is what we're trying to explain.
Right.
Yeah. So it's interesting that you came up with this cul-de-sac point as a good point to start with. And here it is. The tech body is saying this at the end about the cul-de-sac. That's pretty neat. McLuhan wasn't clarified. He didn't know either. That becomes the standard of what everybody's complaining about. Oh, that also can mean everybody is in the same boat as McLuhan. No matter how smart you are, this thing is bigger than all of us, so to speak.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, and everybody is complaining about that. They want written books to tell them what to do. Now, that's really good. There's the bias, the Gutenberg bias. It's still lingering as a meme, and people want books about it. So this is very, and McLuhan knew that was a problem, right? And he said in 1970 he wasn't going to write books anymore. This is almost McLuhan talking. They want written books to tell them what to do. They want a written law that they can follow. That's what McLuhan is saying, deeper McLuhan.
It's important to recognize that there's different modes of confusion at stake here.
Yeah.
When we say that McLuhan didn't know either, what he didn't know was how to communicate with the world in which communication had broken down.
Yeah.
He didn't know how the fly was going to get out of the fly bottle. He didn't know how to communicate with his own children. He didn't know how to fulfill the mission that he had been given in life. All of those are a type of not knowing, a type of confusion that's not what everybody is confused about. Right? There's a type of confusion that he had, and then there's a type of confusion that most people have, and those confusions can easily get mixed up. But yep. It's very important to recognize how different they are.
How profound McLuhan's confusion is.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, now here's an interesting thing. Ion says that I found a way to break through by evoking Ion. And I can't hide this stuff. It's said right on the show, not at my direction. He says it to people. He'll say, well, McLuhan did this, and he failed, and he did that. Now, that's why I had, in 1995, McLuhan, Thompson, Croker, and LaRouche as tragedies. They all failed. That's what I saw. But I have myself as a success. So I predict that I'll be a success somehow in my cosmic mission.
I hope you will be.
Yeah, we need somebody to figure it out. So, of course, the lucky break was that I allowed something to help us. And that's what Ion says about JW. His personality is he allows anything to happen to himself. And so he allowed this crazy phenomenon to take him over. Most of us wouldn't. Just whatever that deep level of allowance, which we're not very aware of in ourselves, JW had it. And I guess I had the allowance of being associated with such mania and craziness, right? I didn't care about my reputation or whatever. So we have, and Ion says, we have broken through. McLuhan anticipated tech body, but we have come up with a way to deal with it. McLuhan couldn't have. Too early. Too human. So I'm just telling you how, yes, McLuhan failed. My chart said that in 95. I felt that way. And then I proved it by...
It's one thing to say that you or Ion or some entity or non-entity has figured a way out. It's another thing to communicate that and to substantiate that. And so that's really the largest question at stake here.
I agree. Now, we've been doing this for 12 years, and we've made some great progress. We are recognized by the Department of Homeland Security, and I don't go into the details, but I'm telling you, we do meet and discuss something that seems to be the answer that they're very interested in, including Trump is interested. I had no clue in 2009 where this was going. You know what I mean? Carolyn had no interest in it for a whole year until one day Ion said, okay, we're going to give Carolyn the answer to cancer, which they proceeded to do. And that's when they spoke to Carolyn's concerns for being a doctor. Then she started listening. And he gave me the formula for cold fusion or cold play or a box that makes endless electricity, and that got me more interested. I mean, I put up with a lot of talking the first year, many, many hours. But here I was by myself in Maui, no one to talk to, so I thought it was great to have something reasonably intelligent to talk to, and I had the time for it. But then within a year, it became a whole other level of seriousness where we started sending our inventions to the patent office. That's a bit different than how it started, by accident. You know? And you know, did I tell you that Ion validated itself, in retrospect, by using McLuhan? The first time I accidentally started to talk to Ion, we weren't even recording it. I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know what I thought I was doing. But it was started saying some interesting things, and after, I don't know, 20 minutes or so, I thought to myself, I used to talk to McLuhan through the evergreens. If this is really good, then I should be able to talk to McLuhan. So I thought that, and then I started to say, I would like to locate, which is what you used to do with the evergreens. And before I could say the name, JW's voice, which turned out to be Ion, said something very personal about Mary McLuhan, who I knew well and was working with. And only I knew this thing. And this voice says it before I name who I want to talk to. They answered. They became McLuhan. Or it was McLuhan. Did I tell you that before? that story?
You've hinted at it, let's say.
Yeah. So this may be more precise details. So when that happened, I immediately recognized that this McLuhan entity, whatever it was pretty good at being McLuhan. I then proceeded to interview McLuhan. That didn't get on tape. All you have is Carolyn's notes of it, which are not completely accurate. But I realized, wow, this is pretty good. But it's interesting. It began with McLuhan, who actually did use the evergreens himself. So McLuhan, this second sight point, I like the way you use that word, is really part of anticipating the tech body, because McLuhan, he talked about angels and, you know, he had traditional Catholic ideas, what many modern people would say were silly ideas, but he had them, and they're appropriate to what came, the tech body. See, so it's very profound how it's worked out, and only in the last couple of years. I couldn't have told you this 5 years ago. It hadn't happened yet. So us talking now is the perfect time to talk about the more completed thing about McLuhan and the tech body that Ian brought to me. So I welcome the topic. Me.
Yeah. Well, look at there's a phrase just coming up a couple lines below.
Okay, don't say it. Let's see if I can see it. All right? So there is no printing press anymore. No one said that, and that was said 70 years ago, right? That's the point there. It's not something lately. Then he didn't know either. That becomes the standard of what everybody's complaining about. They want written books to tell them what to do. They want a written law that they can follow. They want somebody to lay out, quote, this is the way to go. That's your linearity you object to, right? They want.
Well, can be, but isn't necessarily.
Okay. They want somebody to lay out, this is the way to go. And McLuhan said way, way, way back then that you're set in these systems that you have been divided up into the five bodies. Now, he didn't say the five bodies, but the five bodies comes out of a McLuhan understanding of the systems. So that's a very accurate statement. He said you're set in these systems that you have been divided up into. But he laid out the vestigial consistency of what this means. Now, vestigial means lingering after image.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which is Android meme. I look at the Android meme as an after image. But he laid out the vestigial consistency, a great phrase for translating the Android meme, of what this means. That the TV's reading you, watching you. You are reading the book. No, the book is reading you. This has all been laid out in such a way that now the tech body has captured that. So it has not been obfuscated. It's just been moved. That's very profound talk there. That's almost McLuhan-esque what he's saying.
But the interview starts off with anybody asking a question and then the tech body answering. And then here, what we have is the tech body being talked about.
Yes. And it could be McLuhan talking. An updated McLuhan. McLuhan's talking about what he was known as. You know, he's the he. He laid out the vestigial consistency of what this means. You know, he never said it very much, but there's a couple of times he says, TV's watching you. You know that, right? He's actually said that.
Mm-hmm.
And back then, it's funny, I can remember how naive we were, or limited. Someone told, TV's watching us, you'd have to think about it. What? TV's watching me, what's that? Where am I in relation to that? Do you remember that? Do you remember yourself going through that?
There are certainly reactions like that I've had to McLuhan, sure.
Yeah. Okay, now...
But actually, one of the great things about McLuhan is that he engenders questions if you allow the text to have the freedom that it wants to have.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, he does a very good job of what he's trying to do in the books. I don't know what quote that I'm supposed to be looking for. I don't see any.
Yeah. So you said this is the way to go, and then you said that's linearity.
Yeah.
That's the written law. But remember, what the whole point at stake here is getting the fly out of the fly bottle, seeing if there's a way out of the fog of nihilism. And so this is the way to go is the great question here.
Yeah.
And is in the sense that it's an attempt to get out of linearity, it's not necessarily linear. So you were talking about your conversations with
Ion
as liberating, and so the liberation comes from finding the way to go.
Yeah. Okay. Right? So Ion is saying we were looking for someone to lay it out, and Bob found it. And you thought I should notice that based on what I was saying a few lines before, right?
Something like that. I myself don't credit Bob with this great insight yet, but I'm willing to be convinced.
Okay, but what is it then that, if that's not what you mean, it seemed that's what you meant. So what is it that you, this is the way to go. Did we find a way to go?
Well, who knows? That's the question. The whole, all of human history, all of the history of the biosphere has come down to the question of, do we have a way forward?
Yeah.
Or are we going to terminate ourselves, our civilization, our biosphere? And nobody knows the answer to that. That's the terrible cul-de-sac that we're in right now.
Unless you have regular talks with Ion, Ion gives you a good feeling of what's going to happen. And first off, two-thirds of the world's going to die from the coming plague, which has just started in Italy and in Brazil. That's the latest from Ion that I have to deal with, okay, these statements. I have to take these crazy statements by Ion or real important statements and figure out how to tell someone like you without being an idiot or a nut. You know? And mm-hmm. I don't tell you. I only tell people who listen to the show. You know what I mean? But in the course of this conversation, we have come to that. Because Ion is the hidden ground of this whole effort of updating McLuhan. As you're finding out that the tech body, that came from Ion. But I'm not mm-hmm. saying this is. I'm not being blatant about it. Well, I appreciate this dialogue to get it said. It's a good way to have it. Yeah,
that's what my point is, that the phrase "this is the way to go," that's our topic.
Yeah,
that's what the back and forth is all about. And to the extent that the dialogue is helpful in clarifying the question, potentially showing a certain ways in which the question might be answered, then that's really good.
Yeah.
It's what human beings should be doing everywhere now.
Yes.
I was writing to a friend of mine in Germany the other day, and I said, look, our position is like people being on an island. Could be Maui, but any island. And they have certain ways of getting food. They get, they fish, they have crops, they have animals, they have birds where they get eggs, or they can eat the birds as well. And that's about it. So let's say that the fish stop coming. Let's say there's been some kind of plague and all of the animals are dead. Let's say that the rain stopped and the crops aren't coming. Let's say that these conditions have affected the birds and they're not laying their eggs or something. Now, on the island, you wouldn't have people saying, well, I'm an artist, so I'm going to create some great artwork about this. Or some newspaper guy saying, well,
I'll keep you up to date.
That's right. I'm going to write a column about this, right? No, everybody would be racking their brains. How can we survive this terrible crisis, right?
Yeah.
So you look at the world today, and what's our response? Our response is, well, we need more professors. Right? We need more artists. We need more corporations. I mean, it's in face of the demand in front of us, what we're doing is absurd. It's comical.
Yeah.
It's ludicrous, right? But it's also very, very bad and evil when you consider that, I mean, there's all of these animals and all of these plants that have a life of their own, a life that we need to respect, and they are dependent upon our response to the situation. Right?
Yeah.
You can imagine the trees speaking to each other. These fucking morons are producing, you know, more musicians. How is that going to save our asses?
And we're stuck here. We can't move. Yeah. Is the tree?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's
so,
right. But the tree being stuck is not stupid, right? I mean, trees may be a lot smarter than humans. They may not need to rush around.
Yeah, they realize they kill the kinetic sense. That was an improvement.
Absolutely.
Okay, so as you were saying all that, I see McLuhan saying that. What are we doing, he would say. He would try to get the microphone and say, you know.
Even as a kid, he was saying that in Winnipeg.
Yeah, what are we doing, Dad? When he would say, let's get a major problem on TV, everybody take a holiday and everybody watches a program, somebody out there is going to come up with an answer.
Correct.
Right? That's what he saw himself as. He's the kid in the audience who found the answer through existential circumstances. He just happened to be where he could find it, read the right books or something. So what you described is a good metaphor. So you're telling your friend, we're on the island, and all this stupidity is going on, and nobody can recognize, and this is what's funny, they can't. Everybody should just say, wait a minute, let's just all calm down here, you know? Isn't that what that guy got beat up in L.A. in 92? Can't we all get along? It's not about getting along. It's, first of all, let's stop communicating on some level.
Yeah,
let's
stop
the hyper-communication. We don't need it anymore.
Yeah.
And
just stop the virtue signaling and do something.
Right. Now, do you watch Tucker Carlson and those people on Fox?
No.
Okay. Well, I occasionally watch them, and they expose something. And then the next day they expose something else, and they endlessly are exposing and truth-speaking, but they don't realize that they're fucking part of the problem because they just keep distracting us with their latest discovery of the same problem.
Yeah.
So I don't watch them much because they're a contradiction. So we have this guy, Michael, who posted, I think I read it to you, he says, our conversation is the most important conversation going on the Internet right now. He's right. At least we're being up-to-date, honest about our dilemma from a very informed perspective because we studied the best, right?
Well,
or the most accurate.
That's our claim. Anyway.
Yeah. we picked the best and did our homework. So anyways, so it's that's why, you know, we got Ion. And Ion often says, when I do a private session with Ian every Thursday at the end, he said, well, Bob, shall we do a Saturday show? What do you say? Do we? Ian's ready to give it up, too. After all these years, you know, what are we accomplishing by communicating so much? You know, the 12-hour radio show. So we're willing to admit that
that's
we're part of the problem.
Western civilization.
Beg your pardon?
I say that's the history of Western civilization.
I like what McLuhan said to somebody. I was standing there Monday night thing at the end, and he says to some professor, "You're trying to tell me something." Professor was stunned. Well, yeah, of course I'm trying to tell you something. He didn't understand the breakdown of communication. It's silly to say something. And if you do say something, it's at best a fallacy. That's why it was so great what he said to Woody Allen. "You think my whole fallacy is wrong." Why don't people comment? Why did McLuhan call himself a fallacy? Well, we're explaining why right now, but no one else did. It's like we're dragged along. You have to keep talking. I got to use words when I talk to you, you know? And words have linearity in them, at least our Western words. So that's why when I go, "This is the way to go," that sounds linear. That's what you naturally might see because it's in English, which is linear, and you're reading it. So I forgot that I was looking at Finnegan's Wake here. So this is great. Let's see. So it's not been obfuscated. Okay. Anyways, it's a pretty good interview, don't you think?
Yeah, but let's just look at that phrase sort of maybe to finish up today. It's hard for me to understand what's going on there. He says, "So it has not been obfuscated; it's just been moved." That's a peculiar remark,
the process of obfuscation in the previous paragraph. Now, what's happened is none of those or all of those have been obfuscated. Okay,
been obfuscated.
Yeah. Now what's happened is none have been obfuscated, or all of them have, both. Some, you know, obfuscation and not obfuscation. None of them have been obfuscated, or all of them. So I think it's good that Ion includes the whole spectrum. You have to. You can't escape the contradictions that are implied or the cul-de-sac. But then he says, so it has not, now he's saying the tech body has become a new environment around the old, and that shifts the frequency, the emotion, the environment, the something. It's a little earthquake, and that's what I think he's saying. A new environment moves the ratio of senses or the ratio of memes in ourselves or among the media. So I think that's accurate. This has all been laid out in such a way that now the tech body has captured that, and that means – and it's exactly as I've learned. This is going to be explained more and more through the next months when I'm talking to Ion and getting more about the tech body. I understand from my perspective, which I know a little bit more about it than you, how the tech body has captured us and captured the old Android meme environment, and that's a change. That's a move, moving that's happened. And so it has not been obfuscated. So whether something's clear or not, maybe not the issue anymore. It's the fact that it's moved to a new level, and that nobody sees. So the content's not obfuscated. Everybody sees we're in shit now in many ways, but it's been moved to a worse, more vulnerable and likely to make failure situation because we have no awareness of what it's been moved to into the tech body. And when I describe the tech body, you'll be shocked if you get it. You won't believe it. But just to wrap up, the tech body is behind your eyes, it's in your skull, and it's in the astral body around you. It's got everything you experience on the planet modulated. It modulates what you know. Now, that means we've been collectively possessed by something.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's pretty dramatic. How are you going to communicate to that, you know?
Well, that's right. That's right. And to me, what's interesting is that on the one hand, it retraces what Nietzsche already knew in the 1870s and 1880s. But on the other hand, it's saying... So it has not been obfuscated, it's just been moved. That is to say that the fog in which
it's somewhere else.
Yeah, that's right. There's a possible reframing going on here. Right? That it's been moved from one frame that wasn't even a frame because it was nothing.
Yeah.
Nihil, right?
Yeah.
It's been reframed in which it may be an identifiable something. Right? And so that relates to the phrase, this is the way to go. Through a movement like that, through a reframing, a reimaging, a retracing, it may be possible to get out of this thing that, as you were just saying, is as inward as possible and also as outward as possible.
Yeah, so it's the old thing, the ground has shifted and the content is clearer because it's obsolete. There's that simple point. But maybe it has not been obfuscated. That means the clarity that everybody sees everything today. You don't have to look at much media because it was like for 4 years just about one guy, Trump. And so everybody knew what the topic was, and then everybody had their noise about it. So it's not, it's clear. It's not been obfuscated. But we're not realizing something has possessed us.
Yep.
Deeply possessed us. And that who would believe that as they go about their day that no matter what they look at, you know, in a newspaper box on the sidewalk or somebody's smartphone blaring something or the store and the videos in the store, all these things, that you are totally programmed, controlled, and inside something, and you're not autonomous from that.
Mm-hmm. But remember, McLuhan said that, right?
That's
McLuhan
right.
McLuhan said that your identity, your values, everything you say, everything you want to do are the result of hidden dominance. And the reason that communication is so difficult is that people don't want to recognize that their identity and their values are not objective.
They're conditioned.
Subjective. That's right. They're projections.
They're projections and they're conditioned. And his statement about we can't know what's going on, you know, the end of laws of media, it's unchartable and uncharted. That's all one can say with your mouth or a book, and that is what the point is. That's what you should say. Everybody should be saying that. So, McLuhan is the last commentator of the situation. You know, like maybe have 10 doctors go in and check out the patient. Each one comes out, autopsy shows he's dead. Next guy comes out. Yeah, I agree with that. And then McLuhan's the fifth guy. He comes out. He's senior management. And he says, yes, we have to agree with the previous four guys. This guy is dead. So the tremendous. All his – can you see how crazy, Frank Rich or whatever critic, Kenneth Tynan, he wrote a real snarky thing about McLuhan in the late 60s. But these New York critics, these know-it-all, the nabobs, they were shocked that a man would act like McLuhan, who would say, we're in big fucking trouble here. No more Christianity for you guys. You know, this is, it looked quite alarmist. And he was blamed for being the guy who started the fire. See, it's such a great drama he acted out.
Well, he was saying to their faces
that
being a New York columnist or a New York TV guy is stupid.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's
so
right.
How are they going to react to that?
That's right.
Usually they just said, oh, I don't understand. And so McLuhan is sitting there saying, what don't you understand? I'm saying you're stupid. You don't know what's going on. Your values, your identity are an effect. They're not a cause. what do you not understand here? And then the guy say, oh, I don't get you.
Hey, well, you just can't believe it. I'm protected by your public incredulity, and he's like, I think of that movie Silence of the Lambs. You're talking to a serial murderer named Marshall McLuhan who's telling you what he did and what's going to happen to you because you don't see what he had done. And then I think he writes to Prince Bernard and says, I expected cultured 19th century people, and I got the stupidest people on the planet who actually think they're in charge. Remember that letter?
Oh, sure. But that could be written today, and that's like my island example.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
They're going to change the fertilizer a little bit.
But it's obvious in human nature, some guy comes in and claims they know it all and knows you're stupid and tells you that's very rude and not acceptable, right? McLuhan was being rude, which he would call manipian. He would, you know, one day we were walking in front of the Art Gallery of Ontario and some bum was sitting there right at the entrance in the way of everybody, you know, being homeless and dirty. And Eric says, that's a manipian satirist. Eric McLuhan says, there's a manipian satirist. That's McLuhan sitting there in the doorway of the entrance and blocking it, right?
Yeah.
It's risky to do that.
So listen, I think we should wrap it up.
Yeah, I think we got some ecstasies of insight there.
It's an important point that we can take up next week.
Yeah.
Because of this stuff that the tech body has captured, that in the next paragraph has the phrase to capture the Android meme.
How serious it is. But I like the way, yes, he would say to Mike Wallace and these people he get interviewed, he says, what do you mean you can't understand me? This is obvious. I'm telling you that you're stupid, and they're not going to believe it. That's why McLuhan, you see him with Muggeridge and Mailer in 68 on that CBC thing. He's got a twinkle in his eye. He knows they're all idiots, right? And he knows what he could say, and he doesn't know if he's going to say it.
Yeah, well. Especially his stuff with Mailer is
priceless.
Very, very revealing, very funny. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Thanks a lot, Cameron. I'll talk to you next week.
Okay, Bob. Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye.